as they grow older. And it's about bringing all of us together to create real, affordable care choices and quality care jobs for the future.
How would someone get involved in that movement?
You can sign up, and people are signing up every day at www.caringacross.org. And you can learn more about the book and the book tour at caringacrossamerica.com. Please do sign up. We need you. We need your voices.
Ajahn Pooh, I thank you so much for speaking with us on KBOO Portland.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. I have been speaking with Ajahn Pooh, Director of the Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of the Caring Across Generations campaign. We've been talking about her book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 15th Annual Village Building Convergence, May 29th to June 7th, all over Portland. Each day of the convergence, at over 40 sites all around the city, people will create community spaces that feature public art, gathering places, permaculture gardens, and natural buildings. In the evening, there will be speakers, community gathering, and music. The six evenings of events are all held at St. David's Community Center at 2800 Southeast Harrison Street in Portland. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, happening May 29th through June 7th, all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Don Merrill with Political Perspectives, and I'm talking with Martin Ford. Mr. Ford is the author of Lights in the Tunnel, Automation Accelerating Technology in the Economy of the Future. He's written regularly for Econ Future, and he's written several pieces for The Atlantic, and he's just written a new book, Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Mr. Ford, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ford, I wanted to start out by asking you, how did you get on the path of artificial intelligence and robots as a field of interest for you?
Well, I've been running a small software company in Silicon Valley since the mid-1990s. And when I first started out, software was actually a fairly labor-intensive business. You know, we shipped software on physical media, and it had to be sent to the customer physically. So when I first started out, there was work there for regular people, and I actually outsourced some of that to another little company that specialized in that, and they hired, you know, people at different skill levels. But I just saw how rapidly the software business changed, and basically all those jobs evaporated, and now software is delivered across the internet or it's hosted in the cloud, and so there, most of that work is kind of evaporated. And so I came to the conclusion that what I was seeing in my own little business was really kind of a preview of what was going to unfold in the whole economy as technologies like artificial intelligence and robotics became, you know, more important. And so that's what sort of motivated me to start thinking and writing about how AI and robotics would impact the job market and the economy going forward.
You know, a lot of capitalists look at that and see a business opportunity, but you seem to go in another direction.
Well, I think that it clearly is a business opportunity, and that's, you know, that's a good thing, but it also represents a problem in the long run, both in terms of our society and the impact it has on individuals and their incomes, and also in terms of our economy, in terms of capitalism itself, because we need to have consumers out there, people who can buy the products and services that we produce. And if one of the ramifications of technology is that jobs are going to be eliminated, or wages are going to be driven down because there are too few jobs or because the jobs are de-skilled, then what that really means is that it's going to kind of undermine the market. There aren't going to be enough people out there to continue really driving the economic growth and the innovation that we need to be prosperous.
Right. Humans automated agriculture, and then they shifted from farms to manufacturing and mercantilism. And then manufacturing got automated, and mercantilism became commerce and white-collar and services, and now robots are automating those. Where will the vast number of people go now in the future, and why does it seem that people aren't taking this seriously?
Well, that's the real question, and part of the reason they're not taking it too seriously, I mean, you know, it's definitely getting on the radar more than it used to be. I mean, when I wrote my first book on this back in 2009, this was totally a fringe topic. I mean, no one was talking about it or considering it. Now you do see a lot more attention given to it in the media, so people are starting to worry about it. But part of the reason that people are skeptical is that in the past, this hasn't been such a problem. And the reason is that it's impacted sort of one sector at a time on a gradual basis in the past. You know, it started, as you said, with agriculture, and then people moved to manufacturing, and then manufacturing automated, and now everyone works in the service sector. But what we see today is that these technologies are just everywhere. They're impacting everywhere at once. So there isn't any new sector that's going to appear that's going to be able to absorb millions and millions of people that are impacted by this. So we're kind of out of room in the economy, so to speak. You know, there isn't any other place to go because this is now everywhere. It's just completely a general purpose technology.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is going to cause the problem, and I think ultimately it's going to require sort of a rethink of the way things work, you know, the way we do things in capitalism.
Yeah, I really want to talk about that some more. You know, there have been a lot of books that have been written about artificial intelligence that have talked about that impact on society. I mean, whether it's Ray Kurzweil's Age of the Spiritual Machine, which basically said AI was good, to James Barrett's Our Final Invention, which basically said AI had the potential to be very bad. Where do you think your book falls along that spectrum?
Well, you know, I'm focused a little bit more on the economic impact, which is, I think, going to be the first thing we're going to have to deal with. You know, Ray Kurzweil, as you said, he's you know, just relentlessly positive and optimistic about this, and many of the things that he says are true. This, you know, these technologies definitely have the potential to create lots of abundance for us, to make things possible that haven't been possible in the past. But he does tend to completely brush aside the impact on the distribution of income, the fact that, you know, these technologies are, I think, inevitably going to make the skills that a great number of our population have essentially, you know, useless and not very marketable in this new world. And so we're going to have to figure out what to do about those people in terms of making sure that they have an income and they have a way to participate in the economy. Now, James Barrett's book is really looking a little further into the future and worrying about when the machines, you know, wake up and become conscious and have become super intelligent and have the ability to threaten us. And that's actually a topic that's gotten a lot of attention lately because people like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk have also been warning about that. And I think that in the long term, that's a concern that we ought to take seriously. We shouldn't, you know, just laugh it off. But I think that most people who are actually working in artificial intelligence and doing, you know, sort of the nuts and bolts of the research aren't really worried about that. They're pretty humble about where we are at this moment. We're pretty far from, you know, building a machine that can really think like a human being, is going to be conscious and might have its own intentions and so forth.
Well, when
that lies far in the future.
I want to ask you about that because on your Twitter feed, you tell people, relax, the Terminator isn't coming anytime soon. But last month, you wrote a piece for Reason called How to Survive a Robot Uprising. So should people be concerned or not?
Okay, the thing in Reason wasn't written by me. That was actually a review of my book. And it was written by someone else. And it was focused on the, he used the word uprising, but it was focused on the economic impact, the fact that robots are going to take a lot of jobs. The thing is that in order for these technologies to take a lot of jobs, we don't need science fiction artificial intelligence. You know, we don't need machines that can think like people and act like people. We just need machines and computers and algorithms that can do specialized things, and the reason is that most people do relatively specialized things in their jobs, and that's why this economic impact and the impact on the job market, I think, is much closer in time. This is something that is happening now and is certainly going to accelerate over the next 10 or 20 years, whereas this fear about machines really, you know, coming to life and threatening us is further out. Again, I'm not saying that is not something that we should never worry about, but it's not the immediate concern. And I think that at this moment, it kind of acts to distract from the real problem that we're going to face in the immediate future.
In your experience, when people talk about robots, what do they tend to talk about?
Well, the term robot gets used pretty broadly now. I mean, robots are kind of the poster child for this, but
Or AI, much more you could say artificial intelligence, I guess.
Right, it's AI and smart software and really any kind of automation. And for a great many people, it's not going to be anything like a robot at all. It's just going to be essentially software. I mean, if you've got a desk job where you sit in front of a computer and you're doing something that's relatively routine and formulaic, you know, maybe you perform, you produce the same kinds of reports or do the same analysis, you know, a typical what we would call an office drone, someone who works in a big company. Those kinds of jobs are going to be really threatened by this. Those are some of the easiest jobs to automate it, but of course it's not actual robots. It's, you know, it's just software that's going to be able to perform those jobs.
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about which jobs and which types of jobs AI are taking over, and I'd like to start with manufacturing. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Well, manufacturing is already, I mean, in developed countries like the United States, it's already heavily automated. I mean, any kind of job in manufacturing that is, you know, rote repetitive, like standing on an assembly line doing exactly the same thing again and again, for the most part, those jobs are already automated. They've been automated for a long time, you know, for decades. So what we see in manufacturing is that the jobs left for people are the ones that tend to rely on things like dexterity and visual perception, you know, the areas where a worker has to actually see what's going on and then reach out and touch something. Those have been the areas that so far, you know, robots haven't been able to step into. But we are seeing a lot of progress in that area. I mean, the robots are getting better and better. So gradually they're going to sort of eat away at even those relatively small number of jobs that are left. And, you know, we're going to, I think, pretty relentlessly progress toward, you know, full automation. You're going to see factories that come pretty close to basically not having anyone in the factory at all in terms of human beings. And there are a couple of instances where you see that already. The other thing I should say about manufacturing is that here in the United States, not many people work in manufacturing, of course. It's less than 10% of our workforce. But in many other countries, especially China, it's actually going to be a much bigger issue than it is here because, you know, they rely much more on manufacturing for employment than we do. Here in the U.S., the big disruption, the thing that is really going to matter to most people is when automation and robotics impact the service sector and you know, white-collar office jobs, which is where most people are now employed here.
I also read somewhere that robots are going to have a big impact on the fast food industry. Can you talk about that?
Right. I mean, you know, fast food preparation is really, if you look at it technically, it's really kind of like just-in-time manufacturing. I mean, it's like a factory where you're making something rather than making it in advance, you're making it at the moment and then delivering it to the customer. So, you know, economists consider that to be a service, but really, you know, from an engineering standpoint, if you're building the technology, it's actually more like manufacturing. So if we can build robots that in China, for example, are, you know, being used to assemble iPhones and do all this really precision work, then I think it stands to reason that you know, we're going to see robots that can also make hamburgers and lattes and tacos and all the rest of it, because in many ways that's a less, you know, it's a less technical challenge. In fact, here in San Francisco, there's a small company called Momentum Machines, which is focused on building basically a hamburger robot that can crank out about 400 very high-quality hamburgers an hour. I mean, these are like more like you'd find at a Five Guys than a McDonald's. So they're very high-quality burgers, and they envision, you know, this machine maybe transforming not just fast food, but even convenience stores, maybe even in vending machines. So, you know, this is a technology that could be quite disruptive. And I think that, you know, whether this particular example works out or not, it's inevitable that in the industry they're eventually going to move to more automation.
And, you know, talking about food, you know, you go back to farming. How are robots being used in farms, whether they're smaller family farms or larger corporate farms?
Well, agriculture was the first area of the economy to really be transformed by technology. And, of course, you know, this was a long time ago, and it was mechanical technology. It was tractors and harvest machines and all of that. And, you know, but even with those technologies, some areas of farming are really, you could say, they're basically almost completely automated. You know, for example, cotton farming down in West Texas, you know, you've got farms that are basically run by one guy, and he can get on his tractor and hook up machines to the tractor all by himself. He doesn't need any help, and he can basically run an entire farm by himself with no help at all. So, you know, essentially that's the equivalent of fully automating it. I mean, there's one guy there, but there's no real labor content to it at all. So in some areas of farming that are susceptible to this kind of mechanical onslaught are already fully automated. What's left, the jobs that are left, especially for, you know, immigrant workers, are in areas like picking high-value fruits and vegetables that are very, you know, they can be easily damaged and so far have not been susceptible to machine harvesting and so forth. But yet we are now seeing robots step into that role as well. And this is happening particularly in countries like Japan and Australia because they're islands and they don't have access to low-wage immigrant workers. So there's a big incentive there to move to these technologies. And for example, in Japan, they've got robots that can pick strawberries, you know, like one every few seconds, and they do that by looking at the strawberry visually using machine vision and determining if the color is right and if it's ripe and so forth, and then the machine can pick the strawberry. And they can even work at night. They can work around the clock picking strawberries. So you're beginning to see that, you know, these machines step into those roles, and that can have, I think, real implications for employment in agriculture, particularly for immigrant workers, you know, over the next few decades.
And, you know, getting back to the white-collar jobs and the creative jobs, you know, something that's of particular interest to the folks around here is the ability of robots to report the news. I mean, I heard an interview that you did on Fresh Air, and I went to the site that you had talked about, I think it was Forbes or Bloomberg, to read a financial story that had been written by a robot, and I couldn't tell it had been written by a robot.
Yeah, for many stories, you know, there are a huge number that are being produced, and you really can't tell which is which. I think it's fair to say that for right now, it's the more formulaic type stories for the most part. You know, it's areas like sports reporting and financial or business reporting where you're primarily reporting facts. But the technology is getting better and better. It's already beyond simply plugging numbers into some set format. It can already, you know, do more than that. It can figure out, you know, which things are interesting and emphasize those and really weave it together into a narrative. But, you know, research on this continues, and these technologies are going to get better and better. One of the executives at Narrative Science, which is one of the companies that's on the forefront of this, has claimed that he believes that at some point an algorithm will win a Pulitzer Prize, which is maybe a little hard to believe, but that's, you know, that's how aggressive they are in terms of where they think these technologies are headed.
You know, I can remember, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, I think MIT was experimenting with a robot called Kismet. And, you know, jump from there to, I think this robot's name is Ako Kihara, which is a robot in a Tokyo department store that is so lifelike that people don't even know it's a robot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're definitely going to see, you know, machines stepping into those roles. You know, there may be robots that resemble people physically, and that will get better and better. You know, getting it to the point where people really can't tell it's a robot is probably a bit of a challenge at this point. But you will also interact with, you know, smart systems through your cell phone. I mean, you saw how IBM Watson was able to win at Jeopardy, and that kind of technology is going to move pretty aggressively into customer service and areas like that. I think you'll be able to, you know, where now you're getting an offshore worker, eventually you'll call up and you'll talk directly to a machine, and you may not, you know, really even be able to tell that it's a machine. You may be able to take your smartphone into a retail store and access a system and get assistance from a machine that can talk to you, you know, in natural language, you know, and get basically the same help you would get if you were to track down a clerk in the store. So yeah, these technologies are getting, you know, better and better, and in particular the ability to generate natural language responses that can really successfully imitate a person are going to get better and better.
Well, I know one of the things that was a barrier to the kind of robot that people would interact with as if that robot was mimicking a person was this concept called the uncanny valley. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. The idea there is that if you, you know, people can accept kind of a cartoonish robot that looks like a robot or looks like generally like a person, but it's obviously different from a person, you know, more like a cartoon or something, and that's fine. But as you get closer and closer, there's a range where you get very quite close to actually resembling a person, but not close enough that people can tell it's really not a person, and it gets into a range where it totally creeps them out. There was a movie, I forget what it was called. It was a Christmas movie about the train. It was called, it had Tom Hanks was the voice for it. I think it was the Midnight Express or something like that, or the North Pole Express, I forget the name. But a lot of people watched that movie. It was one of those earlier animated movies, and they fell into this uncanny valley. So the characters in this film kind of freaked people out because they sort of looked human, but they weren't... they weren't close enough. So, you know, you run into that problem with robots, but they're definitely pushing it. We've seen some examples of humanoid robots that in recent times that seem to be able to get close enough so that they're really crossing that valley and getting, you know, close enough that people are more comfortable with them, even though they're so close to actually looking like people. So that's, you know, there's definitely progress there.
You know, I wanted to get back to the business aspect of this for a second. Now, a lot of people assume that capitalism could benefit by creating businesses that create robots and maintain robots. But it seems to me that the technology could get good enough to where robots are actually creating and maintaining themselves, couldn't it?
Sure, yeah, they'll do that. And the other thing is that the robots and the machines and the systems will be designed right from the get-go to minimize the amount of labor that needs to be put, you know, into maintaining them and fixing them and so forth. So people always assume that there'll be lots of jobs fixing and maintaining the robots, but, you know, in reality there will be some jobs, but certainly not equivalent to the number of jobs that we lost. I mean, if that were the case, then of course it wouldn't make economic sense to do it. I mean, the reason businesses are doing this is that they're able to on the whole, eliminate labor. So there certainly will be some jobs created, but not enormous numbers. And over time, those jobs may become less and less as we get better and better at designing robots that can maintain themselves. One of the things that will be important is what's called the Internet of Things, where everything is basically hooked together into the big network, and all these machines can be diagnosed and fixed remotely, often by an algorithm that will be able to, you know, figure out what's wrong with it and fix it without a person even being involved and so forth. So, I mean, there will be some of those types of jobs, but not a huge number.
It seems to me that there is a not insignificant social problem coming, because as the population increases and more work is done by automation, I mean, first of all, what are all those people going to do, and how are they going to get money to pay for all these products that robots are creating, you know, so efficiently?
Right, that's the issue that I really focus on in both of my books. I think that's, you know, it's an important point. You can, you know, essentially what it's about is inequality. It's about the fact that we are concentrating income into the hands of fewer and fewer people, and that really undermines the market. Think of it in terms of someone like Bill Gates. I mean, he's got, in theory, an infinite amount of purchasing power. He can buy anything he wants. However, he doesn't want to just go out and buy, you know, tons of stuff. I mean, he's not going to buy 1,000 cars. He's not going to buy 1,000 smartphones. He's definitely not going to sit down and eat 1,000 restaurant meals. So when you take income or purchasing power from 1,000 regular people and you concentrate it all into the hands of one person, and that's kind of what's happening in our economy right now, you obviously undermine the market. You've got fewer consumers out there to buy things. And as that progresses and becomes worse and worse, you know, it becomes harder to essentially drive the economy, because it's ultimately that consumer demand. It's just people out there buying stuff because they want it or they need it that really drives the whole economy. That's, in essence, what it comes down to. So that's critically important for economic growth and also for innovation. You know, we talk a lot about innovation and we celebrate really talented people that create things, but we need to remember that those people need a market in order to have an incentive for innovation. I mean, you could take someone like Steve Jobs. stick him on an island all by himself, and he'd be gathering coconuts just like anybody else. I mean,
right.
His talents would not be worth anything, right, because he wouldn't have access to a market. So, you know, it's really important that in the economy you have some reasonable distribution of income and purchasing power. We don't want to let things get too extreme, or we're clearly going to run into problems and potentially a kind of a downward spiral where the whole economy just kind of winds down because there aren't enough customers out there.
Well, how do you stop it or slow it down? I mean, legislation always seems to be behind an issue, and business and technology always seem to be ahead of government. I mean, how do you slow something like this down so that people have time to evaluate what's actually happening around them?
Well, you know, we don't really want to slow down technology because technology is the thing that has made us better off. I mean, you know, today even a lower middle class person is better off than a really rich person from 100 years ago because that person has access to all this technology. So we don't want to stop that, but what we have to do is we have to recognize the implications of this for the distribution of income, and I think we need to adapt to it. And what I suggest, and I'm not the first one to suggest this, is that eventually we're going to have to move to some kind of a guaranteed income scheme where everyone has access to at least a minimal income so that they can survive in the economy and so that they can also, you know, act as consumers and participate in the market and buy stuff. You know, in today's politics, that's kind of crazy and unthinkable. You know, it's really hard to imagine how that could happen, and yet the paradox is that I think that it's inevitable that we have to move to something like that, some kind of an unconventional solution to this. If we don't, then we're going to run into a big problem. You know, we're going to have inequality on steroids, and we're I think going to run into a potential problem with deflation or this downward spiral where we simply don't have enough people out there to purchase the things being produced.
Well, I've only got a couple more questions, Mr. Ford, and I could really think of a bunch more, but one question I have is I keep reading about how people are losing basic skills, basic grammar skills, basic map reading skills. As computers and automation come more and more into our lives, are we losing the ability to do things that humans have sort of perfected over the hundreds or thousands of years?
To some extent, I think that's probably true and inevitable. It's easy to say that's bad, and maybe in some areas it is. I mean, I used to be able to navigate. I remember back in 2000, I went to Europe and rented a car and drove around using paper maps and figured it out, and I was able to do that, although it wasn't easy. Now, you know, I without GPS, I would be a basket case. You know, I mean, I'd be totally lost, I think. So
if you decided to turn off your GPS, you could still use a map.
I could, but it would be, you know, it would be traumatic. I think, you know, given the extent to which I've come to rely on, especially in another country where you don't speak the language, you know, I mean, it's pretty challenging. So I think, yes, we are losing that abilities. But that's historically, you know, this isn't the first time that's happened. You know, it used to be, you know, you can back in a couple thousand years ago in classical Greece and so forth, people used to use these memory tricks, and they had this ability to remember fantastic amounts of stuff because it was before the age of writing being, you know, really, really used routinely. So people carried a lot more information in their brains, and yet that's something that, you know, has been lost to us. Now we rely on, first we relied on writing it down on paper, and now, of course, we rely on computers. So, I mean, there's a transition there, you know. People lose skills and they acquire other skills, and in some sense that may be a negative thing, but to some extent I think it's just inevitable and it's part of progress.
And this is my last question. Now, I read a lot of comments on comment boards, and, you know, it seems that people are having the wrong discussion. I mean, they're talking about capitalism and jobs and economies when maybe the bigger question is what is our role in the universe. I mean, we have always thought that we were, you know, the captains of our own destiny, but it seems that automation has the potential to take some of that away from us, and it changed the very nature of society and what it means to be a person in society. Do you think that's right?
Well, I mean, these technologies are going to change the nature of the way our economy and capitalism work. So it's important to note that you know, the current model that we have, where everyone has to have a job, and that, you know, your job is really important to you, and it's sort of in many ways kind of who you are, which many people think that's wrong already, but that's kind of the reality in our society, is that, you know, your occupation and the work you do is sort of defines you. That hasn't always been the case. I mean, you know, it's something that within the last, you know, 100 years or so has become sort of the norm, especially since World War II. You know, everyone now works and has, you know, a job that's really important. But it hasn't always been the case. There was a time when you know, work was viewed as less central to who people are. So,
Mr. Ford, I think I'm just going to have to end it there, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Ford, I really appreciate your time, and thank you very much for joining us. Martin Ford is the author of the new book, Rise of the Robots. And Mr. Ford, again, thank you very much for the time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland. That was Don Merrill interviewing Martin Ford. He's the author of Rise of the Robots. It is 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Air Cascadia is off. We will hear Flashpoints and in its entirety. And then at 11, we will hear about how water has shaped our past and how new water challenges are shaping the future on an episode of The Scholar Circle with host Maria Armudian. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member and you want to become one, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Hello, KBOO members. You are invited to attend KBOO's Mission and Vision Retreat on May the 30th from noon to 4 p.m. This retreat is an opportunity for members to support